Hello, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to another episode of Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show that airs on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. During this episode of Arab Voices, episode number 1194, I will have three segments. First, we will listen to the Electronic Intifada newscast, a summary of the latest developments in occupied Palestine, highlighting the Israeli genocide and catastrophic situation in the Gaza Strip and West Bank. During the second segment, I will air an interview Democracy Now! Conducted with Sari Bashi, Israeli-American human rights lawyer, former program director at Human Rights Watch, and co-founder of the group Gisha. During the third segment, I will air the remarks of Rima Salim, United Nations Special Rapporteur on Violence Against Women and Girls, speaking at a briefing organized by the Committee on the Exercise of the Inalienable Rights of the Palestinian People, titled No Peace Without Accountability, From Ceasefire to Justice. Let's begin with the Electronic Intifada newscast, a summary of the latest developments in occupied Palestine, presented by Noura Burrows-Friedman, Associate Editor at the Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada newscast. I'm Noura Burrows-Friedman, Associate Editor at the Electronic Intifada. It's day 790 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Palestine. The Israeli army continues to kill and injure Palestinians across the Gaza Strip in spite of the October 10th so-called ceasefire. Sniper fire, tank shelling, drone strikes, and aerial attacks are routine and incessant, especially in areas east of the vague and invisible yellow line demarcated by Israel. The United Nations Humanitarian Office stated on November 27th that in the areas beyond the so-called yellow line, which comprises more than 50% of the Gaza Strip, quote, daily detonations of residential buildings continue to be reported and access to humanitarian assets, public infrastructure, and agricultural land remains restricted or altogether barred. Access to the sea remains prohibited, the UN added. The UN's Children's Fund, UNICEF, stated on November 21st that at least 67 children have been killed in Gaza since the ceasefire took effect, an average of nearly 2 children killed per day, and dozens more have been injured. On Wednesday, December 3rd, at least 5 Palestinians, including 2 children, were killed by an Israeli drone strike on tents housing displaced people in Al-Mawasi, west of Khan Yunus. Footage by Mahmoud Bassam shows tent shelters on fire as people rush to rescue those trapped in the flames. Also on Wednesday, the Wafa news agency reported that a Palestinian man was shot and killed by Israeli fire in the Zaytun neighborhood of Gaza City. Maha Husseini, journalist and researcher with Euromed Human Rights Monitor, stated on Wednesday that, quote, Israeli tanks have advanced into Gaza City, reaching the Shajaiya roundabout in the east, just a short distance from the city center. This is around 700 meters west of the actual yellow line that was agreed on. Israel's yellow line shifts daily, swallowing more of Gaza's land and quietly forcing hundreds of families from their homes. Israel is exploiting the decline in media coverage of its genocide in Gaza, she said. Israeli army vehicles were reported opening fire in the eastern part of the Burej refugee camp in central Gaza on Tuesday, killing at least one person. On November 29th, an Israeli quadcopter drone targeted and killed 2 young boys, 9-year-old Fadi Abu Asi and his 10-year-old brother Juma Abu Asi, in the Bani Suhaila neighborhood of Khan Yunus. The boys were reportedly gathering firewood to sell in order to buy food as well as medical supplies for their disabled father. In a video report by journalists Doa Mohammed and Samar Al-Boji, the boy's father says they had eaten breakfast and gone into town to earn a few shekels before his checkup the next day when the drone targeted them. CNN said that he was, quote, waiting for them to return so he could set the table, when nearby residents rushed to his shelter saying 2 kids had been targeted and killed by Israeli troops. Are they my children? He recalled asking. An agonizing wait ensued as he went to identify the bodies. I removed the shroud and hugged them. My little Juju's head was blown off. God rest his soul. His arms were severed and parts of his torso were gone, he said. Fadi's right hand and left leg were cut off, he added, according to CNN. The Israeli army admitted it had carried out the strike, calling the small children, quote, two suspects who crossed the yellow line, conducted suspicious activities on the ground, and approached IDF troops operating in the southern Gaza Strip, posing an immediate threat to them. Following the identification, the Israeli Air Force eliminated the suspects in order to remove the threat, the army said. In the week before, on November 22nd, Israel carried out a series of attacks across Gaza, killing more than 20 Palestinians. Footage from Dropsite News' Abed Sabah shows the aftermath of an Israeli strike on a busy Gaza City intersection that killed five people. The Israeli army also attacked homes and shelters in Deir al-Balah and Nuseirat in central Gaza. Reporter Musab al-Sharif filmed a residential building on fire after an Israeli airstrike on the Nasser neighborhood of Gaza City, which killed at least four Palestinians. On November 30th, the Gaza government media office stated that over the 50 days since the ceasefire came into effect, Israel has committed more than 590 separate violations, killed more than 350 Palestinians, and injured at least 900. The media office stated that these violations include 164 direct shooting incidents targeting civilians, homes, residential neighborhoods, and displaced persons' tents, 25 incursions by occupation vehicles into residential and agricultural areas, crossing the temporary yellow line, 280 shelling and bombardment operations by land, air, and artillery, and 118 demolitions of homes and civilian infrastructure. Israel's blockade of essential humanitarian aid, food, fuel, medicine, medical supplies, and infrastructure and construction materials remains firmly in place as Palestinians struggle to get their basic needs met during the harsh winter months. The UN Agency for Palestine Refugees, UNRWA, stated this week that Israel is blocking around 6,000 trucks full of food and relief supplies, including shelter materials and blankets, enough to meet Gaza's needs for three full months. UNICEF stated this week that high levels of malnutrition continue to endanger the lives and well-being of children in the Gaza Strip, compounded by the onset of winter weather accelerating the spread of disease and increasing the risk of death among the most vulnerable children. The agency's director, Catherine Russell, said on November 28th that despite some progress, quote, thousands of children under the age of five remain acutely malnourished in Gaza, while many more lack proper shelter, sanitation, and protection against winter. More food supplies have entered Gaza in recent weeks, driving down market prices and improving families' access to food. However, many essential items, particularly animal-sourced foods, remain unavailable or unaffordable for most, UNICEF added. Meanwhile, healthcare workers in Gaza are reporting that the ongoing shortages of medicine and medical equipment are entrenching the collapse of what's left of the healthcare system. Israel's restrictions on aid entry mean hospitals remain overstretched with critically injured and malnourished patients, and medical supplies have still not meaningfully increased since the start of the ceasefire agreement, stated the British charity Medical Aid for Palestinians, or MAP. Quote, less than 5% of the aid offloaded from trucks in Gaza has been medical supplies, despite the immense needs faced by hospitals following 2 years of Israel's genocide, the group stated on November 27th. Staff at three hospitals supported by MAP report facing severe shortages in essential drugs and supplies, including IV fluids, anesthesia medications, gauze, and vital drugs for chronic conditions. This includes fundamental items required to keep emergency and surgical services functioning. After more than 2 years of genocide and repeated deliberate attacks on every single medical facility, there are still no fully functioning hospitals in Gaza. Ala al-Sharafa, MAP's medical supervisor at Al-Shifa Hospital, Gaza's largest hospital, said, quote, there has been no real increase in medical aid since the ceasefire, and the situation has not improved at all. Nasser Medical Complex, the backbone of the health system in southern Gaza, has 42 essential medical items at zero stock and 43 more nearly depleted, MAP warned. A damaged CT scanner has left Al-Shifa Hospital, quote, unable to conduct essential imaging for trauma patients. During the Israeli military's invasion of Gaza City in September, a second CT scanner was damaged. There is now only one functioning CT machine in northern Gaza at Al-Ahli Hospital. This is placing massive pressure on a single facility and forcing clinicians to ration imaging to the most critical cases. Al-Shifa also remains the only facility in northern Gaza providing dialysis services, but is over its caseload, operating 32 machines for nearly 200 patients, Medical Aid for Palestinians added. For pregnant and breastfeeding women and their babies, the health crisis remains critical. Writing for the Electronic Intifada, Farah Samer Zaina spoke to Dr. Sara Zain Eldain, an obstetrician-gynecologist at Al-Sahaba Medical Complex in Gaza City, who described physical weakness and malnutrition in pregnant women. The following is from Farah's report. Israel's starvation policy during the two-year genocide has severely affected pregnant women, of whom 55,000 remain suffering in the Gaza Strip, according to the United Nations. Quote, most mothers have severe physical weakness to the point that you can see their cheekbones protruding, Zain Eldain told the Electronic Intifada. If pregnant women want to make up for this lack of food by taking supplements, Al-Sahaba's complex's pharmacy has only a single type of multivitamin. Essential vitamins like vitamin C, D, iron, folic acid, omega-3, and magnesium did not enter northern Gaza for too long, midwife Siham Aldib said. Pregnant women are severely lacking them. The scarcity of food and lack of vitamins, Zain Eldain said, have weakened pregnant women's immune systems and led to malnutrition and anemia, with hemoglobin levels dropping. For more, read Pregnant Women in Gaza Face Catastrophic Scenarios by Farah Samer Zaina on electronicintifada.net. Dr. Ahmed Al-Farah, the head of pediatrics and maternity at Nasser Medical Complex, reported this week that more than 85% of essential medicines are gone. Baby formula is still very hard to obtain, leaving premature and newborn babies at critical risk. Reporters Abdallah Al-Attar and Samer Al-Boji recorded Dr. Al-Farah last week.
I'm Dr. Ahmed Al-Farah, head of pediatric and maternity department, Nasser Medical Complex. Today, we want to express about a lot of worry about the collapsing of the health system in Gaza. We are talking about collapsing after the ceasefire. Unfortunately, there is a lot of shortage of essential drugs. Nearly 85% of the essential list of drugs are lost in Gaza nowadays. The food is coming inside Gaza, but the medication, the medical supplies, the milk, the special formula of milk is nearly lost in Gaza. Now we are in the room of preparation of milk for the neonatal ICU in Nasser Medical Complex. As we can see, there is just 5 cans. This will be consumed within 2 days. And this is alarming about the situation in Nasser Medical Complex.
That was Dr. Ahmed Al-Farah at the Nasser Medical Complex. A journalist was killed in an Israeli drone strike on December 2nd. Videographer and drone cameraman Mahmoud Wadi was targeted by an Israeli quadcopter in central Khan Yunis while he was on assignment. Reporter Abdallah Al-Attar filmed Mahmoud Wadi's family and friends grieving over his body and talking about his dedication to journalism. Wafa News Agency reported that Wadi's colleague, Mohammed Abdel Fattah Al-Asli, was injured in the same attack. The Gaza Government Media Office said on Tuesday that with Mahmoud Wadi's assassination, 257 journalists and media workers have been killed by Israel in Gaza since October 2023. On November 28th, the United Nations Committee Against Torture issued their periodic report, finding credible evidence that Israel is operating a de facto state policy of organized and widespread torture and ill-treatment, and that such practices have gravely intensified since October 7, 2023. The report detailed allegations of repeated severe beatings, dog attacks, electrocution, waterboarding, use of prolonged stress positions, sexual violence including rape, molestation, forced nudity and sexual threats, threats against detainees and their family members, insults to personal dignity and humiliation such as being made to act like animals or being urinated on, systematic denial of medical care, excessive use of restraints, the performance of surgeries without anesthesia, exposure to extreme cold or heat, including boiling water, denial of adequate nutrition and water, deprivation of clothing, sleep, and access to hygiene facilities and products, including feminine hygiene products, deprivation of light or darkness, use of loud music and noises, denial of the right to freely practice one's religion in a discriminatory manner against Palestinians and for purposes including the extraction of information or confessions and as a means of exacting punishment, including collective punishment. Adala, the Legal Center for Arab Minority Rights in Israel, along with other human rights organizations, stated that, quote, the committee's findings reaffirm what we and many others have documented throughout the past 2 years. Israel now operates a detention regime that systematically brutalizes Palestinians, strips them of basic legal protections, cuts them off from the outside world, and shields perpetrators from accountability. The committee's observation that Israel maintains a policy marked by organized and widespread torture, collective punishment, incommunicado detention, and enforced disappearance demands immediate international action. Another report this week from the United Nations Trade and Development Agency, UNCTAD, found that Israel's 26 months of genocide in Gaza and continual restrictions, quote, have driven the economy of the occupied Palestinian territory into its most severe contraction on record, wiping out decades of development gains and deepening fiscal and social fragility. The unprecedented collapse, the report states, has, quote, unfolded against a backdrop of longstanding economic and institutional fragility with severe social and environmental consequences. Extensive damage to infrastructure, productive assets, and public services has reversed decades of socioeconomic progress in the occupied Palestinian territory. The resulting economic crisis is among the 10 worst globally since 1960, while the situation in Gaza stands apart, being the most severe economic crisis on record. Some of the statistics that UNCTAD released include a surge in inflation of 238% following restrictions on the entry of humanitarian and commercial goods in Gaza, unemployment at 80%, pushing the entire population of Gaza below the poverty line, and the loss of more than 69 years of human development. Turning to the occupied West Bank, Israeli soldiers killed at least 5 Palestinians during raids and invasions this week. Israeli forces shot and killed 2 Palestinian men on November 27th in the northern city of Jenin in executions that were captured on video. The footage showed Al-Muntasir Billah Mahmoud Qasim Abdullah and Yusuf Ali Yusuf Asasa emerging from a building with their arms raised and their shirts lifted, clearly indicating they were unarmed and posed no threat to soldiers, according to Middle East Eye. The soldiers then shot them at point-blank range. Israeli forces withheld their bodies after the killings, and Israel's National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir celebrated the executions on social media. Al Jazeera reported on Tuesday that Israeli soldiers killed a 17-year-old child, Mohammed Tariq Mohammed Al-Zugair, in the southern city of Al-Khalil, Hebron, after the army claimed he was responsible for a car ramming attack. An 18-year-old Palestinian, Raslan Asmar, was shot and killed near Safa, northwest of Ramallah, after the army alleged he had stabbed 2 Israeli soldiers. Israeli forces raided and vandalized the offices of the Union of Agricultural Work Committees in Ramallah and Al-Khalil, Hebron, on Monday, December 1st, amidst, quote, escalating Israeli targeting of Palestinian civil society and human rights defenders, most recently in the context of the olive harvest season, according to the United Nations High Commissioner of Human Rights' office. UAWC, quote, is one of 6 leading Palestinian civil society organizations designated as terrorist by Israeli authorities in 2021, based on an Israeli legislation that has vague and broad definitions of terrorism and terrorist organizations, which not only risks but has demonstrably led to unjustifiable restrictions on human rights, the UN added. To date, no evidence was provided to substantiate the accusations, the UN said. Licensed under Palestinian law, UAWC has long provided support to Palestinian rural communities and Palestinian farmers facing settler violence and the risk of forced displacement. The attack on the Union of Agricultural Work Committees followed weeks of harassment and public incitement by Israeli settlers and leaders of settler groups, particularly citing UAWC's work during the olive harvest season. This year's olive harvest season is the most violent on record, with 167 settler attacks affecting 87 Palestinian communities recorded as of mid-November. In occupied Jerusalem on November 23rd, Itamar Ben-Gvir apparently ordered Israeli police to raid and disrupt a children's performance at the Al-Hakawati Theater, claiming that it lacked a permit. The performance was entitled Dreams Under the Olive Tree. The Palestinian Culture Ministry said that, quote, this assault constitutes a blatant violation of all international laws and conventions that guarantee the protection of cultural institutions, including the UNESCO Convention for the Safeguarding of Cultural Heritage. Palestinian Culture Minister Imad Hamdan stated that Al-Hakawati Theater is a historic and national space embodying the collective memory of Jerusalem and reflecting the resilience of Palestinian artists in the face of Judaization attempts and land expropriation. He added that the raid was part of a systematic policy aimed at silencing the Palestinian narrative and erasing the city's Arab identity, the Tel Aviv newspaper Haaretz reported. We've published many features on the Electronic Intifada in the last week, including the one I highlighted earlier from Farah Samarzaina, but we wanted to bring you excerpts from a piece we didn't publish ourselves but wanted very much to amplify, since it is authored by our longtime contributor Yusuf El-Jamal, who is based in Turkey. In his new piece for Middle East Eye titled Overnight, an Israeli strike turned my family's home in Gaza into a graveyard, Yusuf writes about waking up to the news that a missile hit his parents' house and killed 9 family members awaiting evacuation, as he says, leaving me with a guilt so deep it feels as if they survived and I did not. Yusuf writes, on September 27th, I woke up at 5:10 a.m. in my apartment in Turkey, feeling suffocated and thirsty. I was uneasy for no clear reason. I reached for my phone to read the latest updates from Gaza. I saw a message in my town's news-sharing group in Gaza that an Israeli airstrike had targeted my family's home. I texted my brother, Aboud, but the message did not go through. Moments later, my mother, who now lives near me in Turkey, called. Her voice trembled with fear as she asked whether I had read the news. I walked straight out of my apartment and down the road to her house. My heart froze and my chest felt heavy. I refused to believe that my worst nightmare during the Gaza genocide had become real, but the feeling of suffocation would not go away. On the way, I called a friend in Gaza. Together, we managed to reach my sister, Sara. That small victory gave me hope that my family had survived. But soon after, Sara told me that Aboud, his wife, also named Sara, and their 2 daughters, Huda and Zainab, had been killed. The airstrike had also killed my sister, Ghalia, her husband, Yusuf, and their daughters, Mariam and Zainab, as well as my brother-in-law, Dr. Khalid. My sister Mariam and 2 of her 5 children were injured. I have experienced immense loss during the Gaza genocide, but it is different when an airstrike hits your own home. Something deeper is taken when the place that helped shape you is destroyed. The missile destroyed not only the walls, doors, and floors I grew up with. It felt as though it shattered the memories that lived inside them, too, ones I shared with my beloved family members in that space. A wave of grief washed over me, leaving a hollow ache in my chest. I also felt helpless and guilty. The night before the airstrike in our home, my sister had sent me a list of 24 family members she hoped I could help evacuate. It included my surviving siblings, nephews, and nieces. They were excited at the idea of being saved from the genocide, of living without fear or destruction, of putting their children to sleep without wondering whether they would survive the night. All of that hope vanished in a single moment. Our lives changed forever. Our home was known for being full of siblings and grandchildren, not anymore. Since the attack, my surviving family members have been busy repairing whatever they can in our home so they are able to return. It's better than living in a tent, they say. But now they must live in a house that has become the graveyard of my siblings, their spouses, and their children. I do not even want to imagine what that means for them. In Gaza, people are constantly forced to choose between 2 bad options. Since the start of the genocide, I have lost 16 immediate family members. Most days, it feels as though those who were killed are the real survivors, while the rest of us who remain carry an unending, overwhelming pain. My guilt for not saving my loved ones increases by the day, and I tell myself that the Palestinians of Gaza, as a community, as so-called survivors, will never be the same. The tightness in my chest also grows with each passing day. The whole genocide feels unreal. To dull the pain and to try to escape from this reality, I imagine that I never lived in Gaza, and that the Gaza that formed me, the Gaza that is gone, never existed. In that world, I imagine my family living in a place where we celebrate their lives rather than their memories. In that world, my nephews would grow up in peace, and their heads and arms would not have to be collected from meters away. In that world, Dr. Khaled would have completed another master's degree in pediatrics. Aboud would have sung for our family and left Gaza, as he always wished. Huda and Zozo would have met my newborn. Mariam and Zainab would have tried on new clothes instead of being buried and burned in them. In that world, there is no genocide, and no political leader doubts Palestinians' right to life. Maybe someday we will build that world together. Those are excerpts from Overnight, an Israeli Strike Turned My Family's Home in Gaza into a Graveyard by Yusuf Al-Jamal, writing from Turkey on Middle East Eye. Yusuf is the Gaza coordinator at the Palestine Activism Program at the American Friends Service Committee. He holds a doctorate in Middle Eastern Studies. He's a Palestinian refugee from Gaza and a senior non-resident scholar at the Hashim Sani Center for Palestine Studies at the University of Malaya in Malaysia. He has contributed to a number of books on Palestine, including Gaza Writes Back and Light in Gaza, and is our dear contributor and longtime friend here at the Electronic Intifada. We mourn for and with Yusuf and his family. And now, as we always do, we wanted to highlight people expressing joy, determination, and resilience across Gaza and around the world. In Gaza, a small team of animators are working with displaced children to make art through stop-motion film as one way to process trauma and tell their own stories. Hanin Kuraz, Shuruk Darwish, and Noor Ajawad of the Animators Workshop Project say that animation here is not just a skill, it is a new language of self-expression, a free space for profound artistic exploration. This short film called When She Left, Life Bloomed tells the story of an elderly man and woman walking together along a quiet road filled with the warmth of memories. Suddenly, a violent explosion shakes the ground, wounding the old woman. She becomes transparent and gradually begins to fade away. From her disappearing body, red roses emerge and drift with the wind until they land and take root and bring color and fragrance back to the barren land once again. The old man remains alone, watching both the loss and the life born from the womb of grief. In his eyes rests a deep sorrow, yet he witnesses love continuing in another form, a rose that never dies. This film was made by children between 9 and 12 years old from Al-Nusrat camp and Deir el-Balah. And that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza. You've been listening to the Electronic Intifada's newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Want to hear more? Check out our live stream with interviews, reports, and analysis, along with print articles, podcasts, and more at electronicintifada.net. Produced by Nora Barrows-Friedman, Tamara Nassar, and Pierre Loisel.
You're listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez at Democracy Now! Conducted an interview on December 3, 2025 with Sari Bashi, an Israeli-American human rights lawyer, former program director at Human Rights Watch, and co-founder of the group Gisha, the leading Israeli human rights group promoting the right to freedom of movement for Palestinians in Gaza. They spoke about the Israeli announcement that it will reopen the Rafah border crossing between Gaza and Egypt as part of the so-called ceasefire, but only open in one direction, for Palestinians to exit. In this interview, the Israeli-American human rights lawyer Sari Bashi says the move validates fears that Israel's goal is to continue the ethnic cleansing of Gaza. Let's listen in.
Israel has announced it will reopen the Rafah border crossing between Gaza and Egypt in the next few days as part of the U.S. brokered ceasefire. According to the World Health Organization, at least 16,500 sick and wounded people need to leave Gaza for medical care. However, the border will only open in one direction, for Palestinians to exit. Since the ceasefire began, at least 347 Palestinians have been killed in Gaza and 889 injured, according to the Gaza Health Ministry. In one recent incident, two children were killed by an Israeli drone for crossing the so-called yellow line, which isn't always well marked. The children were brothers Fadi and Juma Abu Asi, the older of whom was 10 years old. They were gathering firewood for their disabled father. The Israeli military acknowledged the strike, saying, quote, the Air Force eliminated the suspects in order to remove the threat, unquote. Palestinians report Israeli forces continue to cross the yellow line on a near daily basis. This week, a coalition of 12 Israeli human rights groups concluded in a new report that 2025 is already the deadliest and most destructive year for Palestinians since 1967. On Monday, Israeli forces killed two teenagers in the West Bank in separate attacks as they carried out raids across the territory. In Hebron, soldiers fatally shot 17-year-old Mohamed Tariq Mohamed Al-Zugair, whom they accused of carrying out a car ramming attack that injured an Israeli soldier. Elsewhere, 18-year-old Mohamed Raslan Mahmoud Asmar was shot during a raid on his village northwest of Ramallah. Witnesses say the teen was left to bleed out as Israeli forces barred Red Crescent medics from approaching. The soldiers then seized his lifeless body. Last week, the UN reported more than 1,000 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli settlers and soldiers in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem since October 7, 2023. This is Jeremy Lawrence, spokesperson for the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights.
Killings of Palestinians by Israeli security forces and settlers in the occupied West Bank have been surging without any accountability, even in the rare case when investigations are announced. Our office has verified that since the 7th of October 2023 and up until the 27th of November of this year, Israeli forces and settlers killed 1,030 Palestinians in the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem. Among these victims were 223 children.
For more, we're joined in Ramallah in the occupied West Bank by Sari Bashi, an Israeli-American human rights lawyer, former program director at Human Rights Watch. Her piece for the New York Review of Books is headlined Gaza, The Threat of Partition. She co-founded Gisha, the leading Israeli human rights group promoting the right to freedom of movement for Palestinians in Gaza. Sari, welcome back to Democracy Now! Let's begin with the latest breaking news that Israel in the next few days will open the Rafah border crossing, but only for Palestinians to go one way out. What is your response?
So obviously people need to leave. You mentioned the numbers of thousands of patients waiting to leave. There are also students who have been accepted to universities abroad. This is after all of Gaza's universities have been destroyed. So it's half good news. But the bad news is that the Israeli announcement that it will not allow people to return to Gaza validates the fears that many have, that the ceasefire plan, the American plan, and the Israeli plan is essentially to continue the ethnic cleansing of Gaza. So in Trump's ceasefire plan, he committed to allowing Palestinians to return to Gaza, but that's not what's happening on the ground. There has been no construction authorized in the half of Gaza where Palestinians actually live. There has been no ability for people to come back home, and there are people who want to come back home. And life in Gaza is nearly impossible for people because of very, very bad conditions. 81% of buildings have been destroyed. People are living in tents that are now flooding in the rain. And it is very difficult to get construction and other materials approved by the Israeli authorities.
Sorry, there have also been reports of secret evacuation flights from Gaza. Who is running these flights and who determines who goes on those flights?
I mean, that's part of the problem. Early in the war, the Israeli government created what it calls the Voluntary Emigration Administration, which is a secret, non-transparent government body that is supposed to encourage people from Gaza to leave and make it possible for them to do so. There has been almost no transparency about what that organization is doing. There has been deliberate disinformation by Israeli ministers trying to artificially amplify the number of people leaving Gaza to make people afraid. And there have been persistent reports about people paying large sums of money in order to leave. And that is after they've reportedly been asked to sign commitments not to return. On the other hand, there is a very clear statement in the Trump peace plan, which was incorporated into a UN Security Council resolution, that people in Gaza are to be allowed to return home. And it's perhaps not surprising that following the Israeli announcement this morning that Rafah crossing would be opened for exit only, the Egyptian government reportedly issued an objection and said no. It reminded us that the U.S. had promised that people in Gaza would be allowed to come home as well.
And could you talk some about the situation in the West Bank, as we've reported these constant attacks by settlers and the military? What's been the position of the Israeli government on this, and what role have the military played in these attacks?
I mean, the concern is that the violence in Gaza, the violence in the West Bank, it's not random. It's directed toward ethnic cleansing. It's directed toward getting Palestinians to leave. Certainly, that's the case in Gaza, and the devastation and violence there are at a much higher scale than in the West Bank. But in the West Bank, too, just this year, we've had 2,000 Palestinians forcibly displaced from their homes through a combination of demolitions as well as settler violence. Every single day, Palestinians are injured or their property is damaged by settler attacks. And to be clear, settlers are Israeli civilians who have been unlawfully transferred to the occupied West Bank by the Israeli government and have been taking over land that belongs to Palestinians. In the last 2 years, they have become increasingly emboldened in attacking Palestinians, taking over their olive groves, their flocks, stealing, throwing firebombs into their homes, to the point where, according to the UN, in 2025, 1,000 Palestinians have been injured by settler attacks. This is decentralized violence, but it is also state-sponsored violence. It is the government who put those settlers in the West Bank unlawfully. And quite often, this violence takes place when Israeli soldiers either stand nearby and do nothing or even participate. A very ultranationalistic, messianic ideology has been infiltrated into the Israeli military, where you have soldiers whose job it is to protect everybody, including Palestinians, who are also settlers. And on the weekends, they come out in civilian clothing and attack and sometimes even kill Palestinians.
And what about the Jewish and Israeli Jewish activists who stand alongside Palestinians to prevent the olive harvest from being destroyed, to prevent people from being attacked, the response of the Israeli military and the settlers?
You know, it's an indication of just how badly things have gotten, how many red lines have been crossed, because it used to be that Jewish settlers would be reluctant to attack Jews because their ideology is racialized. They believe that they are acting in the name of the Jewish people. But recently, they have attacked Israeli Jews as well, when Israeli Jews have come to accompany and be in solidarity with Palestinians. So we just finished the olive harvest season. It's a very important cultural and also economic event for Palestinians. And this year it was particularly violent, with Israeli settlers coming, attacking people as they try to harvest, cutting down and burning down trees, intimidating people. And there have been cases even where Israeli Jewish activists came to be a protective force by accompanying Palestinian harvesters. And they too were attacked and even taken to the hospital with injuries. It is much more dangerous to be a Palestinian than to be an Israeli Jew in the West Bank. But the fact that settlers are also attacking Jews is an indication of just how violent, messianic, and ultranationalistic this movement has become.
The death toll from Israel's more than two-year assault on Gaza has been reported as 70,000. A new study from the Max Planck Institute for Demographic Research in Germany said the death toll likely exceeds 100,000. Our next guest, Ralph Nader, has talked about the Lancet report, saying it's probably hundreds of thousands. Life expectancy, says the Max Planck Institute in Gaza, fell by 44% in 2023, 47% in 2024. If you can talk about this, and also what is going to happen in Gaza now, where the truce stands.
I mean, the violence against people in Gaza has been unprecedented. It's been genocidal. And, you know, we have confirmed 70,000 people whose names and ID numbers have been reported by their families to the Palestinian Ministry of Health. There are thousands more people believed to be buried under the rubble, and thousands or tens of thousands of people who died from indirect causes. So these are people who, because of a deliberate policy of starvation, died of malnutrition, died of communicable diseases, died of want. And I don't know that we will ever know how many people died indirectly. This is for a very small population. It's a population of 2 million people. In Gaza right now, life has remained nearly impossible. The ceasefire promised reconstruction. It promised the crossings to be open. But the U.S. government introduced a number of caveats, and it actually, unfortunately, got those caveats approved by the U.N. Security Council. And an important caveat was that the reconstruction elements of the ceasefire would be limited to areas where Hamas had had disarmed. And if the Israeli military was not able to disarm Hamas and other Palestinian armed groups in 2 years of war, it's not clear how they're going to be disarmed now. So conditioning reconstruction on Hamas disarmament is basically saying reconstruction will be impossible. The only place where the U.S. has said it will allow reconstruction is in the more than 50% of Gaza that is directly occupied by Israel, that is off limits to Palestinians on penalty of death. So that doesn't leave people in Gaza with any options. 600,000 school children have no schools. The hospitals are barely functioning. There's nowhere to live. 1.5 million people are in need of emergency shelter supplies. The concern is that the way the ceasefire is being implemented is only going to contribute to ethnic cleansing, because anybody who can leave Gaza will leave, because it's very clear that there's not a future being allowed there. And the United States has an opportunity to make good on its promise in two ways. First of all, it can make it clear that reconstruction has to be authorized in the part of Gaza where Palestinians live, not in the half of Gaza that's off limits to them. And second of all, it should demand, as per the ceasefire agreement, that Rafah be open in both directions, also to allow people to come home.
And I wanted to ask you how the Israeli media is reporting both the breaches in the constant breaches in the ceasefire agreement, as well as the constant attacks on Palestinians in the West Bank, and what's been the impact on public opinion since the ceasefire came into effect, Israeli public opinion.
You know, I'm very sorry to say that there's been a long-term trend of the Israeli media becoming more nationalistic and less critical. And that's been matched by a number of government moves to co-opt and take over both public and private media. So particularly since October 7th, 2023, the Israeli media, with a few notable exceptions, has been reporting government propaganda uncritically. So what you will hear in the Israeli media is that suspects were shot in Gaza for crossing the yellow line or approaching troops. You won't hear that those suspects were 10 and 12-year-old boys who were collecting firewood, and that under international law, you can't shoot children because they cross an invisible line. In the West Bank, you will hear that terrorists were taken out, when you mean ordinary civilians who were trying to harvest their olive trees. There, Haaretz and a few other media outlets have been offering a different view of what's happening, a more realistic view. But right now, many Israelis choose not to see what's happening either in the West Bank or Gaza. And interest in what's happening in Gaza has gone way down since the majority of Israeli hostages have been freed.
What you just heard was an interview Democracy Now! Conducted with Sari Bashi, Israeli-American human rights lawyer, former program director at Human Rights Watch, and co-founder of the group Gisha. You're listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show on dozens of radio stations in the U.S. and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. The Committee on the Exercise of the Inalienable Rights of the Palestinian People, a United Nations body, held a briefing on October 30, 2025, titled No Peace Without Accountability, From Ceasefire to Justice. One of the speakers at that event was Rima Salem, United Nations Special Rapporteur on Violence Against Women and Girls. Let's listen to her remarks.
It's an honor and a privilege for me to address this committee today, although, of course, I would have loved if it had happened in better circumstances, as it's quite alarming and shameful that, as we are meeting here today, the deliberate killing of Palestinians, including women and girls, has not ceased, despite the fact that there is a quote-unquote ceasefire in place, yet hundreds of Palestinians continue to be killed. As it's my first meeting with you, I have to admit that since becoming a mandate holder, I have never confronted a situation as daunting as the one we had since October 2023. Documenting the human rights violations of the last 2 years and acting on them has been a challenge beyond description, primarily because it has been impossible to do justice to defining and describing the crimes and horrors that Palestinians, including women and girls, which are under my mandate, have been subjected to. As I have been saying, it is my belief that the current legal terminology, the concepts, and the legal frameworks that we have are inadequate in front of the monstrosity and the scale and the horrors of what Palestinians have been going through, particularly over the last 2 years, and including women and girls. Just to give one example, it became very clear to me that referring to the deliberate mass killing of Palestinian women, because they are both Palestinian and female, could no longer be adequately encapsulated by the term and the concept of femicide, which, as we know, is what describes the deliberate killing of women and girls because they are female. Instead, it was clear to me that the mass killing of Palestinian women and girls was happening with the intent to destroy them and, through them, the larger group to which they pertain, the Palestinian people, in whole or in part. In other words, it was clearly a tool of genocide and in the service of it. Hence, I characterized in my last report to the Human Rights Council the killing of Palestinian women as femi-genocide, which is a term that was first coined by an Argentine anthropologist, Rita Laura Segato, to describe precisely what I've just described, the systematic violence against women rooted in patriarchal, racial, and colonial power structures. Now, if we look at the bigger picture, in fact, every act committed by Israel was geared to serve the overall objective of destroying the Palestinian people and ethnically cleansing Gaza and also the wider Palestinian occupied land. That is why every sector and other colleagues of mine working on thematic issues have also struggled with terminology and have also described things like ecocide, environmental destruction through toxic weapons, domicide, intended erasure of homes, scholasticides, the deliberate and mass elimination of schools and destruction of education. And I even know of the description used to describe the collapse of international law due to Israel's impunity, legal side. Moreover, and after the beginning of the genocide, it has become very clear to me also as a mandate holder from observing and studying the modus operandi, scale and intent, that reproductive violence was very much used as a genocidal tool in Gaza. Again, therefore, as a deliberate tool to impose measures to prevent births within the group, as described by the Convention on the Prevention of Genocide. And I was very glad that South Africa included that in its legal brief and arguments in front of the ICJ, and that the ICJ also made a reference to this article. And I was also very pleased that the Commission of Inquiry on Palestine reached the same conclusion, elaborating in one of its reports in detail how Israel has systematically targeted reproductive health facilities, maternity hospital clinics, including the IVF clinics, destroying access to life-saving care for women and infants, not to mention what we have all documented, including myself, shortly after the start of the onslaught on Gaza, the widespread and rampant sexual violence, torture, arbitrary detention, forced disappearance, and psychological violence being inflicted on men, boys, women, and girls. Mr. Chair, ladies and gentlemen, I know we might sound like broken records, but we cannot underestimate the enormous damage that is being inflicted on the international legal framework and the rule-based order. What we have said repeatedly is, and it continues to be relevant today, is that what happens in Palestine does not stay in Palestine. The fact that crimes against Palestinians, including women and girls, can continue with such impunity has shown the weakness also of the feminist discourse and feminist policy. For all the concerns that are raised about global regression in the rights of women or the pushback, as we hear, the continuity of the killing of Palestinian women and girls in the thousands and the infliction of horrors on them is really the most defining moment that declares that the world no longer cares, in fact, for the lives of women and girls or their safety or their dignity. And we already see the ramification of the normalization of such brutality elsewhere, most recently in Sudan. It's as if what is happening in Sudan is using the playbook of what was inflicted on women and girls in Gaza. And it is really, really alarming that after 2 years of the world watching a genocide unfolding on its screen, we have normalized it to such an extent that no one now bats an eyelid about what is happening to women and girls in conflict and crisis situations elsewhere. So as I said, what happens in Palestine does not stay in Palestine. It has also exposed the double standards in the feminist discourses of organizations and states alike. I continue to find it very disappointing that despite the wide documented sexual violence that has been committed by Israel and its forces against Palestinians, including women and girls, states have continued to be very timid on this issue and not to address it, including those that have feminist foreign policies. And we have seen also how this discourse on human rights has also shattered with the reaction to the pro-Palestinian movements around the world. Female human rights defenders that have been detained and imprisoned, including those participating on the flotilla, have been subjected also to very gendered punishment and consequence and violence. Now, since this session is also about accountability, I would just like to reiterate one point. In my view, and this does not apply only to what has happened in Gaza or the West Bank recently, but really is relevant to the last 8 decades of Palestinian, of the dispossession of Palestinians since the Nakba. In my view, there is an insufficient consideration of how Palestinian women and girls experience these oppressions and realities in the ongoing accountability processes. So in the deliberations of international courts and prosecutors, and also some human rights mechanism. So if I can mention one example, the ICJ advisory opinion of July 2024 on the legal consequences arising from Israel's policies in the OPT failed to mention the very specific and distinct ways in which Palestinian women and girls are affected by Israel's occupation and apartheid, especially regarding family life, freedom of movement, access to health, including reproductive health rights, and vulnerability to violence. Also, the General Assembly resolution that reaffirms the findings of the ICJ advisory opinion of July 2024 was also sex and gender blind. Now, this is, in my view, a lost opportunity. We have to document and do justice to the specific gendered experience of Palestinian women and girls, which constitute, after all, half of the Palestinian people, and demand accountability and reparations for them. And we should perhaps also start with the Palestinian women detainees that were also recently released as part of the ceasefire arrangements. Even the last advisor opinion by the ICJ rendered in October 2025 made only one reference to the fact that by withholding assistance, humanitarian assistance, Israel had breached its obligation under CEDAW, which requires it to ensure non-discrimination in accessing health services for women. But again, in my view, this is not enough. And this sex and gender blindness when it comes to accountability procedures for Palestinians must be reversed. I also would like to mention that with regards to states that continue to cooperate with Israel, including through the export of weapons, they also are violating their international obligation towards women and girls set out in the various international instruments. And we have to continue to hold also these states accountable, because these obligations are also included in their own national export risk assessments. They are under obligation not to export arms to places and to countries or actors that commit violations against women and children. And this is one of the recommendations I also made in my report to the UK after my visit in 2024. I think the priority right now also is to ensure that independent human rights mechanisms like ourselves can access the occupied Palestinian territories, and that we are able to also document the horrors that were committed on October 7th and since October 7th against all. Thank you very much.
That was Reem As-Salem, United Nations Special Rapporteur on Violence Against Women and Girls, speaking at a briefing organized by the Committee on the Exercise of the Inalienable Rights of the Palestinian People. You've been listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. Our shows are archived online, and you can listen to them by visiting arabvoices.net. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.